Hello and welcome to Lush Tums, the podcast, supporting you on your mothering journey during pregnancy, birth and beyond. Through yoga, education and community, we enable every woman we work with to connect more deeply to herself and her own innate wisdom. Find your tribe as you become a parent, making positive, informed choices that are right for you, because Lush Tums believes everything has a place. Join the two Claires as we connect, laugh and learn. In this space, everything is welcome. Hello everyone and welcome to Lush Tums the podcast. I'm Claire McGill.
And I'm Claire Maddalena.
Today, Claire and I are joined by someone who is a bit of a celebrity in the birth world. Together with her partner Alex, Toni Harmon made the documentary film Microbirth, asking the question, could birth and infant feeding affect a child's long-term health? It won awards and instigated discussions and changes that are happening today. Their follow-up book, The Microbiome Effect, brought together more information and questions about what we can learn about the role of bacteria in birth, feeding, and our ongoing health. Gut health and probiotics are hot topics, but how does it all begin? We're so excited to welcome you, Toni. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm super excited to talk about my favourite subject, so thank you.
Oh, lovely to have you, Toni. We've loved your documentary and we share it as much as we can. So it's such a pleasure to have you here. Thanks for giving us some of your time.
I honestly love talking about who knew that microbes could be so fascinating. And I love sharing this knowledge and bringing it to a new audience. So thank you.
Absolutely. So for those that are perhaps new to your work or new to the whole concept of the microbiome, maybe we could start at the beginning a little bit. Those that are aware of your work know that this is actually a very personal beginning to your story and to your work. So would you like to tell us a little bit about how it all began?
It's a little bit of a long story and a bit of a, but it began when, okay, so I was a filmmaker, I was a professional filmmaker. We just made our first feature film, which is a horror film, actually, a psychological thriller. When I say we, it's myself and my partner, Alex. We make films together. And so we just sold our film and we thought we were on our way to Hollywood. And then I discovered I was pregnant, which was fantastic, brilliant. And it was really exciting. And as a filmmaker, part of making a film is preparing. Preparation is everything. So I threw myself into preparing for the birth and for breastfeeding. And I went to two different antenatal classes. I went to a breastfeeding class. I thought I was fully prepared and I made a birth plan. It's really simple. I just wanted a home birth and to exclusively breastfeed. That's all my birth plan had. And in the event, as sometimes happens, I ended up with an emergency C-section and had no support for skin-to-skin and no support for breastfeeding. And I felt really disempowered and really upset, actually, just kind of that the birth that I was wanting didn't happen that way. And it wasn't so much I was upset with that, because that sometimes happens. But a lot of the decisions that were made about what happened were not made by me and were made by doctors outside the room. And I wasn't involved in the discussions. And that kind of kick-started something, and it left me with loads of questions. And so my partner Alex and I, we went looking for answers. So we started, first of all, we made a film about doulas, because had I known about doulas, then I would have had a doula, because doulas are fantastic and provide such brilliant support during pregnancy, birth and the early infancy period. So made a film about doulas, and then we looked into the politics of childbirth and made a film called Freedom for Birth, which looked at the human right to give birth, how and where you want, with whom you want. And we premiered that with 1,000 screenings all around the world, all happening in one day. And it just kicked off this, we have people marching in the streets of different cities around the world, coming straight out of the film. And I, at the time, I couldn't see there was another side to human rights in childbirth. I couldn't see why anyone would argue with a mother's right to give birth where and how and with whom she wanted. I couldn't see the other side of the argument. Turns out there was another side of the argument, because I got deluged by all these angry emails from people saying, how dare you tell mothers this? How dare you inform mothers that they have choice? So we took a step back and thought, right, okay, that kicked up a hornet's nest. Let's look at the science of childbirth. And that's when we discovered the science of the microbiome. And so for the last 10 years, we've made a film, Microbirth, and we've written books, we've created courses. At the moment, we're setting up an international conference all about the microbiome. So it's kind of a journey from making feature films to where I think I'm meant to be in the world right now. And it's a really exciting world and a really exciting place. And I'm honoured to be in this place, and I'm honoured to be found, to have discovered this little kind of niche. And I feel so passionate about it, and to communicate information about what happens during this really sensitive time, during pregnancy, birth and breastfeeding.
Amazing work. It's such a calling, isn't it, when we find that thing that can help others and make a difference, and that we feel passionate about and could talk about all day. Aren't we all blessed to have found that with our careers and our work? So I've got a question, Tony. That the microbiome, it's a word, we hear it a lot. When I teach my antenatal education classes, lots of people have never heard it before, maybe just in relation a little bit to maybe gut health, for example. But why do you think it's so important that we look at the infant microbiome for like a child's longer term health? You know, what are the kind of broad strokes that we can share with people that are listening about the benefits of this?
Okay, so you're right. A lot of people have heard about the microbiome. Some people haven't, but people have heard about gut health particularly. And there's a lot of marketing of probiotics, so you kind of hear about it. But the most important time, the most sensitive time in a person's life for establishing and founding the microbiome is in this narrow window that surrounds birth. So the microbiome, in general terms, it describes the community of microorganisms that live on and in us. So that's the trillions of bacteria, viruses, fungi, protists, archaea. And most of that population of trillions of microbes are harmless. The vast majority are harmless. Many are beneficial to human health. And a tiny fraction are pathogenic, are harmful. And the microbiome, those microbes that live on and in us, they are completely integral to our health. So they help with our immune system, they help with digestion, metabolism, they have anti-infective properties. There's a gut-brain connection, so what happens in your gut affects your brain. And so scientists are also linking the gut microbiome with all lots of different conditions, from obesity, diabetes and cancers, asthma, allergies. They're all connected to the microbiome. And what happens during birth, so as a baby develops, the baby develops inside the amniotic sac, inside the womb, and is mostly protected from the world of microbes. But as soon as the amniotic sac breaks, so that's the rupturing of the amniotic sac, which is the breaking of the waters, that usually happens before or during labour. So if you can imagine the baby's in a sterile environment and suddenly the sack of waters breaks and the baby's now exposed to bacteria and is first of all exposed to the mum's beneficial microbes in the mum's vagina, and then as the baby comes out, hopefully the baby will be exposed to the mum's gut microbes. This is the ooey bit, but it's brilliant, right? So hopefully, on the way out, the baby will get a good lick of the mum's bum. And that is brilliant, right? Because, and hopefully, there'll be some poo there. And the messiness of birth, I've been to births can be really, really messy. Lots of poo, and that is brilliant. Absolutely fantastic. Because that's the baby's exposure to the mum's beneficial gut microbes. With those, and then if the baby's put skin to skin, the baby's going to acquire the mum's skin microbes. So, and there's more microbes in breast milk too. So the baby's first exposure to microbes, the beneficial microbes are going to come from the vagina, the gut, and from the skin, all from the mum. And then this is the exciting part. So within breast milk are these special sugars, these HMO sugars. They're indigestible by the baby. And these sugars, they feed the beneficial microbes transferred from the mum to the baby during vaginal birth. And those special sugars ensure those beneficial microbes quickly colonize the infant gut. And that ensures optimal immune training. So that's why it's so important. It's establishing the gut microbiome, founding the gut microbiome with the right beneficial gut microbes, because that's going to protect a baby's health lifelong. So it's integral to immune training, and that happens in the first, scientists think about the first 6 months. And you have one chance for immune training, so you have one chance to get it right. And if you miss that window, if you miss that six-month window, then your immune system might be maleducated, which increases the risk of all these conditions.
Totally fascinating. And those sugars that are in the breast milk, have we managed to replicate those in infant feeding formula, just to be really clear about whether that's there or not?
So everybody's a great question. So everybody's microbiome is unique. So every mum has a unique microbiome, and within her breast milk are a unique set of HMO sugars, so human milk oligosaccharides. And scientists have identified up to 200 different HMO sugars. So each mum is going to have a different set of HMO sugars in her breast milk, which are perfectly matched to the beneficial microbes in a vagina and gut. It's this beautiful kind of system. Okay, so formula milk have identified, I think, up to about five, maybe six HMO sugars. And they don't, so within, naturally within breast milk, HMO sugars change. They change over a day, they change over a week, over a month. They change according to the mum's diet. They change according to the as the baby ages. In formula milk, those HMO sugars, which are in formula milk, don't change. And they're not personalised to the infant. So chemically, they might be the same as a few of the sugars in breast milk, but they're completely different. So they're not personalised to the mum. And as one of the scientists we interviewed said, it's like someone standing on top of a building being as close to the moon. So the moon is your breast milk, and someone standing on top of a building is like the HMO sugars in formula milk.
That is a really great analogy, and from a scientist as well. So that's really interesting. Thank you.
One of the questions I was going to ask you about was if we struggle with feeding our babies ourselves, as some people do, and we can spend hours talking about perhaps lack of support and information and the right care for new mothers as they learn to feed. On a basic level, I know that we often use donor breast milk for babies that are in NICU or are born very, very premature. It sounds like, you know, in an ideal world, it would be a direct mum to baby contact, the breast milk going that way. Do you think there's still huge benefit in donor breast milk?
Definitely. So on a scale, so it's mum's breast milk from breastfeeding at the breast, right? It's top of the list. And then if the mum is able to express milk, that's fantastic. Even just a few drops of colostrum, it would be fantastic. And the more milk she can express, that's brilliant. And so when that isn't possible, then donor milk, if that's available, that is an option. Because it, as well as these HMO sugars, human breast milk from whichever source has these multiple complex components. So you've got loads of immune components, growth components, growth factors. You've got all the nutrition a baby needs. So if that's possible, then that's a great option. But it's not going to be necessary. It's not going to be necessarily matched perfectly with the baby. So within human milk banks, sometimes they do a they mix up different milk coming from different mothers, and so there'll be a swirl of different HMO sugars. So it might be within that swirl the beneficial microbes might be fed by the right HMO sugars, just within that swirl. Very untechnical term, but you get the idea.
Yeah, absolutely.
So within the swirl, so the baby might get the HMO sugars, but it's not personalized to the infant. And so beneath that, so formula milk is great, and it's really is good that we've got it as an option for those baby, for those babies who can't have access to human milk for whatever reason. So within formula there is the nutrition to survive, but it's not personalized to the infant. So it's I'm not trying to make a mum feel guilty. I think it's, for me, it's raising awareness and informing choice. And and it's in terms of preterm infants, the most there's a paper published, I just blogged about it this week actually, that the more breast milk a preterm baby gets, the better it is for the brain development of the baby. So there was a study that looked at preterm infants born before 32 weeks gestation, and the more breast milk they received, so, and that was from breastfeeding or from express milk or donor milk, this study included, it showed that the cerebral cortex, so the baby's brain, was as developed at term, so at 40 weeks, around 40 weeks. For those babies that received higher quantities of breast milk. So yes, it does make a difference, and yes, there needs to be some more support, and yes, there needs to be more information, but it's kind of getting this message to mums that every drop of breast milk counts, really.
I was just sort of thinking about that lovely swirl analogy. That's such a good idea. And then there's the other piece of that donor conversation, which is about the accessibility. You know, is donor milk only really accessible if you've had your baby early, or is anyone who's struggling with breastfeeding able to access some sort of donor milk bank? And do we have anything nationally that supports people, or is it just kind of you have to find your own person to donate to you? How does that bit work, Tony?
To be honest, each region has their own different milk bank access guidelines. And some areas are better served than others. And I don't know, I honestly don't know if there's a national human milk bank. I don't know if there is. I know there's different areas that have milk banks and they are accessible. I also know that there's this is kind of getting to the dark waters. I mean, there's human milk being sold on the internet.
Wow.
And the human milk from donor milk banks is pasteurized. So they kill off the bacteria within the milk and they screen for any infections. And I know the kind of the dark web of human milk sales, where you can buy someone's breast milk, that doesn't go through screening, and it might not be personalized to your baby. But is it better than formula milk? I don't know. Mm. So there is, I mean, I'd love it. I would love it if every single mother who wasn't able to give her baby her own milk, or for whatever reason, had access to donor milk. I think there just needs to be more education and more support and more financial support, really.
Absolutely. I know that there is a sort of unregulated face group where it's kind of mother to mother support or mother to parent support, because of course sometimes there's no mother for the baby, and I know that there are fathers who want to access breast milk for their babies, and I think that's done, you know, on a voluntary basis, not for money, and with nothing but goodwill and heart behind it. So I think that's worth noting. It would be lovely if that was supported more, and perhaps people could feel more assured that that there was little risk in giving that kind of milk. But if people weren't aware and if it was something they were very passionate about, that, you know, there is that option out there, obviously done at your own risk, not regulated, not gone through pasteurized means. Interestingly, when you said sort of killing off the bacteria, I was thinking, oh no, you don't want to do that, do you?
Well, that's the thing. So it's a really sort of complex thing that breast milk not only just has these personalized HMO sugars, but also has a personalized set of microbes in the breast milk. And if you pasteurize it, that basically kills off all the, makes the milk sterile. So you're killing off all the live bacteria in the breast milk. So there's risks and benefits, and it would be lovely if, say, there was a donor scheme that was regulated, that was kind of free to access, that had the mother's milk screened and somehow matched up from mother, so from donor mother to, you know, so it could be that, say, sisters have similar breast milk, or from people from the same family. I think we're just sort of scratching the surface of what might be possible. Mm-hmm. And I'd love more research to go into this, and I'd love more accessibility.
And then we've got the question about the donors as well. It's like that the sisters, that makes sense. I saw an article once about a grandmother breastfeeding her own grandchild, and obviously she hadn't fed any infant for decades, but when her grandchild was born, she was able to support her daughter by breastfeeding the grandbaby herself, which I thought was incredible. Like, our bodies are amazing, and I just don't think in our, you know, super clean culture that we know that we can do that. So would that be, if you've had a child before, you can initiate breastfeeding again as a donor at any point, or can you initiate breastfeeding without ever having been pregnant? How does that bit work?
Okay, I'm not a breastfeeding expert and I'm not a lactation expert, so this is kind of beyond my realm of knowledge. But I know that people can relactate. So if the breastfeeding was interrupted for whatever reason, the mother can be supported, if say with a support from a lactation consultant, to relactate. It's not always possible. It can be possible. And I know that men can lactate somehow.
Wow.
And I don't know how that works. So I can imagine that a grandmother can relactate, but because the thing with the microbiome is that when you're pregnant, your bacteria, your microbiome changes in preparation for birth for birth and breastfeeding. So your gut microbiome changes and your vaginal microbiome changes. And also your oral microbiome changes, your mouth microbiome. So if you're relactating, or you're a grandmother, or this is like beyond my expertise, right? But I can imagine your microbiome hasn't changed because you haven't been pregnant.
Yes.
So I'm not sure. I'm not sure. Honestly, I don't think anyone's researched that.
Interesting. So fascinating.
It absolutely is. I'd just like to sort of reiterate a point that you made earlier, which is that every drop of breast milk counts. And I think the vast majority of breastfeeding mothers I know combi feed their babies, exclusive breastfeeding, for lots of reasons, sometimes is a bit out of reach for people, or they choose not to. And so there is sometimes this kind of narrative that is one or the other, that you either breastfeed or you formula feed and there's no in between. But actually, if we can say to women, you know what, even if you're just doing one feed a day, even if you just gave colostrum for that first day of your baby's life, that will have had a benefit. That does matter. You did a really great thing by doing that. And for as long as you breastfeed, those benefits remain as well. So if you're combi feeding or continuing to breastfeed your child beyond 6 months, to the recommended 2 years by WHO or beyond, that's still going to have that benefit. You're still going to be, you know, the benefit, breast milk doesn't lose its benefits, and even the tiniest amounts are still going to be beneficial, even alongside formula. Would you agree?
I absolutely agree. And I think that's a really powerful message to empower parents, that as much breast milk as possible is, just talking microbiologically, not talking mentally or kind of all the bonding and all the other kind of benefits of breastfeeding. That said, it's an important message that breast milk is not the same as infant formula. And I know that's a difficult message, particularly if, like you say, most people are combi. I really struggled to breastfeed, and I ended up topping up with infant formula. And but I do know that infant formula is not the same as breast milk, and infant formula interrupts the optimal seeding and feeding of the infant microbiome and increases the risk of certain conditions. And I know that's a difficult thing to say, and I know it's a difficult thing to hear, and there should be more support for breastfeeding. I think it comes to education and breastfeeding. So yes, absolutely, it's an important message that every drop of breast milk counts. At the same time, there needs to be knowledge that from feeding with infant formula can impact the infant microbiome.
So fascinating. And it's that kind of long-term health benefit that I'm sure is quite tricky to measure and study when we're looking at huge populations. You've spoken to lots of scientists. What are some of the key things that you think we could share today from some of that research that's happened about those sort of long-term benefits for health? Because it still sounds kind of abstract as well, doesn't it? If I do this thing and sort out that microbiome, then it's going to help my kids not have allergies or not be diabetic or, you know, whatever. It still sounds quite a leap. So what are some of the other facts that you've gleaned that you can share with us, Tony?
Okay, so the research is saying that a dysbiotic gut microbiome, so that means an unbalanced microbiome, so that means that your microbiome, there might be an overgrowth of certain bacteria, it's not in balance. What you want is a balanced, diverse microbiome, because that helps protect you. So if a dysbiotic gut microbiome is linked to all these different conditions or increased risk, so your increased risk for, you know, your asthma, allergies, your diabetes, obesity, cardiovascular disease, some cancers, a long list. Things like multiple sclerosis has a link to the microbiome. So neurodevelopmental disorders are linked to dysbiotic gut microbiome. This is a link. It's not causation. It's just a link. So scientists don't know whether it's a dysbiotic gut is causing it, or just because if you have a condition that that reflects in your dysbiotic gut. So it's kind of, that's at the moment, it's a link. But the good news is that things you can do. So
great.
Can I just clarify, when you say there's an increased risk of those things, am I right in thinking that's roughly 20%, or is it?
All different conditions have different risk, increased riskness.
Where could people find that information? If you're a numbers person and you want to see the stats, where would they look?
Just like Google risk of Google microbiome risk of whatever disease it is. So off the top of my head, yes, the increased risk of asthma, there's papers which say around about 20%. I think it's risk of type, I can't remember which one, whether it's type 1 or type 2 diabetes is the increased risk. This is all about the infant microbiome. It's like 46% increase, something like really high. Risk of obesity, I can't remember what the actual statistics are. So it's just that different conditions have different increased risk. That's not to say that all babies are going to have this. So there's three main things that affect the optimal seeding and feeding of the infant microbiome. So that's C-section, exposure to antibiotics, and formula feeding. They're the ones which have been identified as the three factors that can impact the infant gut microbiome, which leads to, well, is connected to, this increased risk of these diseases. But, okay, can I get back to what? Yeah, right, so the good news. It starts early, so it actually starts before before conception, if you're thinking about having a baby, it's eating things which will affect your microbiome. Because if you think about it, your microbiome is going to be part of your baby. You want your microbiome in the best possible condition. So starting before pregnancy, ideally, or early pregnancy. So this is I've got this thing at the moment. We've got to get this information to parents early in pregnancy. So it's simple things like eating diverse range of fruit and vegetables, eating more fibre, all the things that are fermented foods. So your sauerkraut, kimchi, yogurts. So that's all your kind of diet. So eating a healthy diet, which is microbiome based. But things like walking out into the country, getting exercise is really good. Getting fresh air, meditation, sleep, all the things that you kind of go, oh, it doesn't really matter. Actually, it does matter, because there's lots of research saying if you get a good night's sleep, that impacts your gut microbiome, and that helps kind of decrease all the factors that make your gut microbiome unbalanced. So it's sleep, it's exercise, it's houseplants, it's getting a dog is really good if you're pregnant for your microbiome. So there's research that expectant parents growing up on a farm are in decreased risk for these different conditions. So one scientist we interviewed said, ideally you'd want, if you're pregnant, to have a cow in your house. Not possible. But he was just sort of saying, just because it's this exposure to nature, we are too clean. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's having a sensible approach to antibacterial products. So if you're using raw chicken around your house, absolutely. If you're slapping chicken around your kitchen, absolutely, you're going to want to use maybe antibacterial cleaners to clean it up. But just generally, just not being too clean and not being obsessively clean. And I know that's difficult if you're pregnant, because you want a clean house. And there's a difference between a clean house and a sterile house. And a clean house is good, but it's just not being too... So you kind of want a farm in your house, but like a safe farm. So a dog is really good, because dogs go outside. They spur around outside. They kind of go into the mud and dirt and sniff each other's bums and all that sort of stuff. And then they come in and they run around your house and they lick you, and then they lick different parts of your house and they spread microbes around, and that kind of helps balance the microbial ecosystem in your house. So getting a dog is really good. We don't have a dog, but we borrow a dog, and so it's just as good. So we don't have any of the vet bills. We just get this, and we take this dog for a walk, and we kind of encourage it to sniff around outside, and then we kind of come back and say, go crazy, and it kind of licks us, and it is just like this crazy charged microbial thing that we have. And then the owner comes and we give back their dog, and it's like, great.
I'll be honest, that sounds like way more fun than taking two capsules of probiotics a day, doesn't it?
And, well, that's the other thing. So probiotics is a bit of a wild west at the moment. There's there's good research which suggests certain probiotics are good for certain health conditions or to rebalance your gut, right? So some probiotics or prebiotics are the kind of high fiber. So prebiotics and probiotics, they can be really good for you. However, it's a bit of a wild west just in terms of marketing. So you go on Google, you go on Amazon, and there's just hundreds of different types of probiotics, all boasting the same type of benefits. And I would say, if you're listening to this and you're thinking about probiotic, look at the research. Look at the research and find the ones which have the good research behind it, not generic white label probiotics that you might not even get what it says on the bottle. As research says, that some probiotics don't actually deliver what they say they're promising. But a good quality probiotic with good research behind it, that may be beneficial for certain conditions. But there's also research which say that maybe it might not be beneficial, because everybody's microbiome is unique. It might work, it might not work, it might unbalance your gut if you've got a kind of, you know, a few billion microbes of a certain thing. So it's finding the research, looking at it, and that's one of the things that we try to do is try to make the research really easy to understand, because most research papers are so difficult and written in this crazy language, which makes it completely inaccessible by anybody. Mm-hmm. So I try to write a weekly blog where I kind of take a recent paper and say, okay, these are the main findings, making it easy to understand. So yes, I think there's education is key, and information and just awareness, really.
Is there, for I would expect for the vast majority of us, maybe even some of us with this knowledge, I know very few people who will, even with the best intention in the world, have managed to, had the vaginal birth without the antibiotics, who've managed to exclusively breastfeed for 6 months, no antibiotics given in that time, or perhaps the first year of little one's life. There's nearly a lot of people are going to have interrupting event, if you like, or something that's stopped that. What can they do? Is this where, again, probiotics come in, or is there anything else we can do if things haven't been kept as sort of perfect as we would have liked them to be? What can we do?
Okay, so breastfeeding. I mean, I know I keep banging on about it, but breastfeeding or express milk or human milk is the number one for a baby, is the number one thing that can help restore the baby's gut microbiome. So that's a really important message that, okay, so things might not have gone right at birth. But things like even sort of with C-section, so support for skin-to-skin during the C-section. So the baby delivered onto the mum's chest, and then support for that, and to support for uninterrupted skin-to-skin on the mum's chest, and then support, extra support for breastfeeding. I know I keep banging on about it, but it does come back down to it. That's the number one thing. In terms of probiotics for infants, there's some research that some probiotics may be better. And I'd just say to a mum just to inform yourself and to look into it. So, but it does come back to the same things, that it's just kind of, it's good diet, it's exposure to all these kind of the natural world. Exercise is really good for your microbiome. I'm not saying babies need to exercise, but if the mum's microbiome is in a good place, then that's good. And not just the mum too, it's the dad, the partner. Because you have an ecosystem in your home. So, you know, I said about the dog running around and being this kind of microbial highway. So your other people in your house, you kind of share many of the same microbes. So it's not all on the mum. It's on the partner or the dad or the siblings to have a healthy microbiome themselves too. So there's things that kill your microbiome. So alcohol, which is a bit of a shame. So some alcohol is good. Loads of alcohol is maybe not so good. These antibacterial cleaners. We went to my partner Alex when was looking for pants, for underwear in a supermarket the other day, and I don't know why he was looking for kind of underpants, and we went to the supermarket, and every single pants that were on display in the supermarket were antimicrobial pants. So antimicrobial pants. So that's basically killing off your bacteria in your nether regions if you're a man. I didn't look at the female ones, but I was like, that's just crazy. I mean, so there's, you know, so, I mean, I'd love, so within the next, you know, 2, 5, 10 years, we'll have kind of probiotic pants, probably.
I love that.
So, and I'd love to see that, or, you know, so just thinking more, you know, beneficial microbes as opposed to killing microbes.
You kind of mentioned nature and kind of living in a farm environment. So I guess when we get our veg, trying to make sure it might be organic, and do we not want to like over scrub it or peel everything then? Are we kind of looking to have a little bit of dirt, you know, on our food that we're actually ingesting those microbes?
I think it's just kind of having a sensible approach, really, that I read a study this week where nearly half of American children don't eat vegetables, any vegetables. So I found it really shocking, but having been to America, not so shocking, because it's actually quite hard to buy fresh fruit and vegetables in some places in America. Here in the UK, it's much easier. You go to a supermarket, you can buy fresh. So it's just this education that, you know, whole foods. I mean, I know it's a message that it's a very common message, like plant-based food. Meat is so at least chicken stock or beef stock is good, which is a difficult message for vegetarians or vegans. But it's plant-based foods, eating real vegetables, and being aware of their source. So, and just, I don't know, just having, we've got, because of what we've learned about the microbiome, we've got an allotment now. We grow our own vegetables. And we know exactly what the dirt is on those vegetables because we've put it there. And so we don't clean our vegetables that well because we know the good quality of the vegetables, and we're completely organic in our allotment and in our farming, our mini farming. If I was to buy a vegetables in a supermarket, I'd wash the vegetables because I don't know if they've been, I don't know, sprayed with pesticides or herbicides or whatever. So if you know where your vegetables are coming from, then yeah.
Embrace the good bacteria.
I would love to find out a little bit more about, you suggested skin to skin in the theatre of the C-section. I feel like there is a move for that more to happen more now, possibly the reasons being more about bonding and regulation of baby's temperature and things like that. But actually, you know, the fact that we know how beneficial it is for the microbiome, it's just another reason why this should be kind of rolled out wherever possible. What about things like vaginal seeding, which are now they're not as well known or understood? It's one of those things that's still quite niche at the moment. Where do you feel that that's something that we're going to see more of in the future?
And maybe for the people that are listening, you know, for the first time ever, and they might not know what vaginal seeding means, could you just shine a little light on the definition for that, please, Tony?
there's some research which is ongoing. So this is only a subject of research. It's not recommended anywhere. It's not supported by any medical organisation anywhere. However, if parents know about it, then they can look to be informed themselves, and they could approach their healthcare professional and say, I want this, right? But at the moment, it's a subject of research. So what it is that before the baby's born by C-section, so this is, the research is only on elective C-section only. So so it's not emergency C-section because this goes out the window. It's elective C-section. So this is a C-section by maternal request or because there are factors. So sometimes if the baby's breech or say it's a second time round and the baby was born by C-section first time round, there's different factors to make it elective. Anyway, so what happens for an elective C-section and the mum who wants to swab seed or vaginally seed is that a sterile swab is inserted inside the mum's vagina about an hour before the C-section. Then the swab's taken out and the baby's born. And then as soon as the baby's born, the baby is wiped with the swab, which is coated in the mum's vaginal bacteria. So the swab is wiped on the baby's mouth, face, body. And the early stage research says that this can help restore at least the skin, baby's skin microbiome, and it could restore some other areas of the microbiome too. And this research is ongoing. We've got this conference in April where one of the lead clinical researcher is talking. She's just about to publish a new set of results. So I'll know more about the new set of results. So right now, it's a subject of ongoing research and it could be something for the future. So the preliminary studies say it could help at least partially restore the baby's microbiome if the baby's born by C-section. However, there's a caveat to that in that it's not recommended if the mum is colonised by group B strep, so test positive for group B strep, or if the mother's vagina has other pathogens, or there's a whole risk of exclusion. So the study, so their exclusions are things like if the mum's over 35, age 35, which is crazy, but other, and it's low risk mums only as part of this research project. So it could be that this is something for the future. And it could be that if mums inform themselves about it, this could be something they ask for, or look into at least, and look at the options. And if you know, if you have your vagina tested and you know there's no pathogens in there, and you want to go ahead with that, then there should be nothing stopping you.
I suppose there's always an argument as well that if the C-section wasn't happening, the baby would be born vaginally anyway and would have come into contact with these things regardless. And obviously in our country, we don't have the levels of screening that they do in other countries. And there's still obviously a lot of debate around whether the screenings are actually beneficial or have different outcomes based on the screenings. So it obviously is a huge topic, but I think it's something people perhaps might want to think about or to consider, if this is something that they're really interested in, if this is something that they feel is important, if they're having a C-section where they feel lots of choices have been taken away from them, maybe this is one where they can reclaim a bit of that power.
I think it's tricky because the full results of the study haven't been published yet. And it's not recommended because of this. So group B strep is the number one issue that's often raised about the microbiome. So what happens with group B strep? And group B strep is, so between 10 and 40% of mums are naturally colonised by group B strep. And we have it, many of us have it inside us, a part of our microbiome, and it's a very normal part of the microbiome. However, if a mum is colonised by group B strep and then has a baby vaginally, I think it's about half, so 50% chance of the baby acquiring group B strep during vaginal birth. And for the vast majority of those babies, it has no effect on them, it's part of their microbiome. But for some of those babies, they develop an infection. And for some of those infections, it can be fatal. Mm-hmm. So that's why as soon as someone says group B strep, it's like, gosh, right, let's get those antibiotics in there. And right now, there isn't really a solution to it. So there's two different strategies that countries use. There's the risk-based strategy. So it's identifying those mums who are at higher risk of group B strep. Things like if your waters are broken for an extended time, if you've got a fever going into labour, lots of different factors, or if you've had a group B strep baby before. So other places around the world have a universal screening system where every mother is screened for group B strep, and those mums that test positive for group B strep are automatically given antibiotics. So it's really difficult because the life of the baby is the most important thing. Everybody wants to make sure that baby is alive and healthy. And so, yes, it's kind of like this kind of, there will be a solution for group B strep in the future, and that could be a vaccine, or it could just be that there's a probiotic developed for group B strep, or whatever solution. So I'm confident that within the next 1 or 2 years or 5 years, there will be a solution for group B strep, so that these babies are not exposed to antibiotics during labour. But we're not quite there yet. And I don't want to advise anybody to do anything with group B strep just because it can be fatal. And the infections, if a baby does develop an infection, it can happen really, really quickly. And a baby can be born and go from being born to being very seriously ill very quickly. And I think the medical professionals, so midwives and doctors, they've seen it happen, so are very risk averse, let's say.
Mm. I suppose just to be clear, in our country, we don't routinely screen for group B strep. From what I've looked at and heard, it's because it can change almost day to day. It's like you can test positive for it one day and test negative for it the next day. And then that comes back to that piece that you were mentioning, Tony, about, you know, the healthy lifestyle, the sleeping well, the eating well, the getting out in nature, doing all of those things just to maintain your health can help lower your chances of having a positive group B strep test result, I suppose.
I don't know if what the research is of in terms of diet, how that can affect your likelihood of having group B strep, or if you, because it's a commonly within your microbiome, it's part of the balance of your microbiome. It's just that there are risks attached if you have a baby vaginally. That's why with the swab seeding thing, because we don't routinely test for group B strep, so UK doctors are very averse against vaginal seeding, because there's this risk that if a baby is born by C-section, there's a very little risk, particularly if the amniotic sac is intact, there's a little risk of that baby coming into contact with group B strep. So
I suppose it comes down to risks versus benefits, doesn't it? It's like if you want to have your vagina swabbed to maybe get the benefit of seeding the microbiome, and you're happy to take that risk that there might be group B strep in it, or other people might look at that and be like, no, I'm not going to do the vaginal swab. So it's going to end up being that individual choice, looking at benefits, risks, and what they feel is best for them and their baby in that moment.
I think it's having discussions with your healthcare professional. So having informing yourself and then talking it over with your healthcare professional, whether that's a doctor or your midwife. The worst thing that could happen, I think, is to maybe secretly do it, to secretly say swab seed, and then the doctors or the midwives don't know about it. And then the baby is a chance of the baby getting kind of an infection. That would not be great. So it's kind of in partnership, really. It's informing parents, informing healthcare professionals what to do about this. And at the moment, we don't have the large population-wide study, and that's happening at the moment. So with about the risk versus benefits for vaginal seeding. So I don't know if I was having a C-section, I would probably get my microbiome tested and to see,
and then make a decision when you've got more information. Yep. Interesting stuff.
But just as an aside, I did test positive for group B strep with my daughter, and immediately was sent leaflets and guidance from the hospital. So I had planned a home water birth with her. I already had the pool ready set up, and I got this letter through saying, you're going to have to come in, you're going to have water antibiotics and everything. And I was really upset because I hadn't actually consented to the test. They had done it without my knowledge while I was in hospital. And the thing that made me angry was, like, if they hadn't done that test, I wouldn't know any different. I'd be just carrying on with my plans, just like all the other people out there that carry on with their plans. And so I really looked into the figures, and I literally got out my calculator and my pen and paper, and I was like, what is the chance of my baby being dying from group B strep? If I do nothing, what is the chance? And the rate was basically exactly the same for stillbirth rate anyway. And I thought, well, for me, I now know, and this is the great thing about knowledge, I now know that if my waters break early, if I have a high temperature, if there are signs of infection, I know what to look out for in my baby should she get poorly. Now, I wouldn't have known any of that, and I think everyone should know those things so that they can make an informed choice. But I chose to go ahead and have uninterrupted home water birth with the support of the midwives against, you know, I was then deemed high risk, because of that. And actually the consultant I spoke to was very supportive and said, yeah, you know, you sound informed, go ahead, you know, have a great birth. I did, as it was, she was a precipitous labour anyway, so there wouldn't have been chance to get antibiotics in me regardless. And so I'm really glad that, and actually so from my very personal and unrest, I get quite upset the idea that antibiotics are just given out willy-nilly to what, you know, to prevent what is actually such a tiny, tiny percentage. So I know you can't ever make that choice for someone else. And, you know, I think everyone should have that right? But sometimes when it's talked about, and you quite rightly say, you know, no one wants to lose a baby, that's the worst thing imaginable. But like, sometimes I feel there does need to be a bit of perspective around the numbers we're talking about and how a third of women have it at all times anyway. So the only choice really would be to have everyone have antibiotics. And, you know, what's the, that kind of, you know, all the work you've done suggests maybe that's not a great idea.
I mean, it's really tricky. It's really tricky. And, and just because I would love there to be a simple non-antibiotic solution to this. And it's not, we don't have it yet.
Yeah.
And so I'm all about informed choice and to raise awareness of, and for to encourage mums to look into the science and to look into the risks like you did, to inform themselves, to make the risk that's and to discuss those risks with your, I think for you to talk about it with your obstetrician, brilliant.
And I think in terms of general conversations that people face with their healthcare providers, often we get told the risks of not doing something that they would like us to do, but we don't get told, you know, the risks or the benefits of doing what we're thinking we might want to do. So it's often quite a weighted discussion on one side, you know, to tell you what could go wrong if you don't. So I think that language and that narrative needs to be opened up a bit so that they also encompass the benefits of if you don't, and you know, the risks, you know, they've got to do both sides of the coin, really.
Absolutely. There's never ever been as far as I'm aware, a discussion around the risks of taking antibiotics, and don't we think that maybe should happen?
100% agree.
I definitely think, and I think we're moving towards it now. Because antibiotics have been so overused, and there's the rise of antibiotic resistant genes, and I think it's an important conversation that needs to be had. I think we don't necessarily have answers yet, but it comes down to information, informed choice, and doing what's right for you and your baby and your family, and what's right for you in a particular set of circumstances. What might be right for one person might not be right for another person.
Absolutely. That's we're definitely preaching from the same hymn book there. That's what we are all about. So that's really interesting to hear. Do you think it's going to be a key part of discussions with healthcare professionals in the future?
Yes, because that's part of we've got a master plan. So we've got our first conference coming up. We're having more conferences. We've got a new film coming out. And so we're going to have the same model where we have thousands of screenings happening all on the same day, all about the microbiome, all about why it's so important. The audience of this new film is our expectant parents, and parents to bring this awareness to parents. I think change happens, and the awareness of the microbiome comes from parents being informed and expecting care that looks after their microbiome. So putting the microbiome first, that's kind of what we're creating. And then at the same time, we're also supporting healthcare professionals and education for healthcare professionals, and giving a chance for the health system to prepare for this tsunami wave of parent interest in the microbiome. So it's like two sides. So we create the parent demand, or we help set the conditions for the parent demand, and then at the same time, we help the health system to be prepared for that tsunami of parent demand. And if we can bring more people into the conversation, so more and more people talk about the microbiome, we set the conditions for a tipping point to happen. And that tipping point can happen very quickly. So that's my goal over the next year, 2 years, is to create the conditions for a tipping point where the microbiome does get incorporated into normal medical care, and that there is support for the microbiome during pregnancy, during birth, during breastfeeding. I know I keep banging on about breastfeeding, but breastfeeding, more support, more financial support, more physical support for breastfeeding whenever possible. That's what I'd like to see. And donor milk, you know, having options for donor milk when possible. Having what I'd like to see is for every parent whose baby needs to be born by C-section, for those parents to have immediate support for skin to skin during C-section, which means there's a set of procedures that need to happen for a family-centered cesarean. So that's things like having the cannula in the non-dominant hand so you can hold the baby, lowering the screen during the birth, arranging the medical professionals so that the mum can actually have skin to skin in the operating theatre. It's at the moment operating theatres are kept really, really cold, and so the baby's like comes out freezing. So it's kind of maybe warming the operating theatre so that the conditions are right for the baby. All those things that can happen, and that if we can create the conditions where parents expect it to happen, then we can create the demand, and the demand needs to be met by the healthcare system. So that's my mission at the moment. That's why I'm on this podcast.
The power's with the parents. That's something we always say, you know, if we want to implement the change, you know, it starts with the parents. So, yeah, we love that, Tony.
It's wonderful.
Good news is, since watching your original documentary, Microbirth, and doing antenatal education just here in Brighton, I do know of quite a few parents that went off and did all their research, and quite a few that ended up choosing to do the seeding and were completely supported by the healthcare professionals in the environment at the time, which I thought felt like a very quick response from the great big structure of the NHS. I felt like that was a very quick response to respond to new information and people's choices. So I was really chuffed to hear that.
I think that's great. I mean, I think the more support, so the more parents can find out about the microbiome and learn about it, and the more that health professionals can be supported to support the parents, then everybody wins, and we can change the health of the next generation.
Absolutely. And I love that you're coming at this from a, you know, purely scientific basis, but actually all the things you're saying from a human community nurturing perspective for the mental health benefits, for the all these things are going to support that as well. Putting the family right at the centre of the care again and looking at their unique circumstances and ensuring that they have the support that they need, is it's not going to, well, undoubtedly it will lead to better health outcomes just because of the reasons we've been discussing, but it's going to lead to better, happier families, happier relationships, all those things. So I'm really excited about that. I'm so pleased to hear that. You know, I think so often we are pushed with a lot of doom and gloom in front of our eyes and how wrong everything is and how, you know, bad or how far away we are from where we want to be. And every now and again, you just get this glimmer of things that are definitely moving in the right direction. Thinking of optimal cord clamping being now standard practice, and that's happened within the time I've had my children. You know, change really can happen, and, you know, benefits from that can be felt in a very quick time as well as long term. So that's just wonderful. I will get all the details about your upcoming work at the end and put them in our show notes, and Claire and I will definitely be at the screenings. And to do a little bit of a U-turn, if that's okay, and talk a bit about autoimmune conditions, which is, again, something, you know, I think when I was a child, I don't think I'd ever heard of an autoimmune condition, not really. And now it's very much part of our vernacular. There's lots of things about it in the media. It seems like nearly everyone's intolerant to gluten nowadays, or, you know, more serious conditions, things like lupus, and we have alopecia in our family as well, so and thyroid conditions. What do we know about the microbiome in relation to that, and are we looking to the microbiome to potentially reverse some of those things?
This is like an ongoing research. I mean, the microbiome is a hot area of research right now, and all different conditions are being related to the microbiome. I don't know if there is research on, say, alopecia and the microbiome. I don't know. I don't know if there is. But definitely your autoimmune conditions. It starts, this is why this sensitive period during birth and early infancy, you've got 6 months to optimally train your infant immune system to recognize what's friend and what's foe. So if the immune system is optimally trained in that narrow window that surrounds birth, then the immune system will react appropriately to what is a friend, so will tolerate what is a friend, and will respond, or if there's a foe, will attack the foe. So that's how your immune system is supposed to work. And if it's not appropriately trained during that narrow window that surrounds birth, then it will identify something that is a friend as a foe and attack it. That's how you get to autoimmune conditions. It's the kind of the step. It's the immune training isn't right. So what you can do later, it might be that all the things I talked about, your diet, your lifestyle, your getting into nature, all of those things, sleep, meditation, all the things that kind of are good for your microbiome, could potentially, I don't know, reverse different conditions, but definitely could play a factor. We filmed some scientists and some people with MS, and so who follow a protocol where they have a plant-based diet, and with so they're plant-based, but they also have some meat, because there's things in meat that you can't get from plants, just for this particular condition. So not against vegetarianism or veganism. So they have kind of beef stock. And they have a quite a strict protocol of, I think, 9 cups of fresh fruit and vegetables a day, so up to 30 different plants and vegetables a day. And they have exercise routines, and there's a strict protocol. So they've reversed their condition. So by following the microbiome-led kind of way of living, they've reversed their conditions. I'm not saying that can happen to every condition, but that's what they've found with that particular, so multiple sclerosis. So yes, so I think it's just we need to rethink everybody. Now that we know about the microbiome, and now we know it's so integral to our immune system, integral to our digestion and metabolism, and our overall health and our gut brain. There's a gut brain connection. So how you think and your mood. All of us, now we know about it, I think we could all benefit from living a life more in balance with our microbes. So every once in a while, we do a kind of a 30-day microbiome, I'm not going to say makeover, but microbiome thing, where we try to up our intake of fiber, and we try to get the dog over more, and just we kind of do a splurge, and we feel better for it. So that's like an N of one, you know, so just us and our family. And we feel better, and we go for more walks, and it's something really good about it. And that might just be a placebo effect, that we're actively going for it. But I don't know, it's kind of eating more vegetables, eating more fiber, eating, just being aware of it. You can make these small changes, and that can potentially impact your health. I'm not saying it definitely will, but it can.
And I think the other piece of what you just said as well is, in our culture, you know, you go into the supermarket and you kind of look around everything. Really, there's only a tiny amount of actual healthy food in a ginormous supermarket. You know, the fruit veg aisle, ideally the organic bit, the little bit of, you know, grass-fed beef, you know, organic chicken. And then most of the stuff in the supermarket you actually want to chuck in the bin, with all the processed stuff, seed oils, the modified maize starch, you know, the fructose, the glucose. I literally read every ingredient thing and walk around, and most of the stuff goes back on the shelf, because I suppose if we're putting all of that in, your body's got to spend so much time detoxing it. It hasn't got time to take that little bit of nutrient from that vegetable you've had. We've kind of got to eat clean and avoid all of that rubbish stuff at the same time.
So within, if you look at the ingredients list, so emulsifiers, so I'm not a food scientist, but this is just what the scientists have told me. So emulsifiers, which are a very common ingredient, so emulsifiers are things you find in spreads and stuff,
mayonnaise,
because what it does, it breaks down, so something emulsifier breaks down the cell walls, right? So if you put it in food stuff, it means it's kind of like creamy, smooth. But if you think about having emulsifiers in your gut, so if they break down food products to be, they break down the cell walls, that's what they're doing to microbes, the beneficial microbes. So there's, you know, so and eating things like sugar, processed sugar, is there's lots of research about the impact of processed sugar. And you're absolutely right, Claire, that it is difficult to find real food. I'm not saying that everybody has to, you know, clean eat, but just having balance, really, that eating foods with less processing, if it's possible to, could be more beneficial.
It's almost like that continuation of the idea that most of us are going to be combi feeding or whatever, but can we, it's worth getting in those extra veggies and fiber, and you know, every bit of homemade from scratch meal counts. So
yeah, even if it's just that one a week, then you know, that's an achievement. And it kind of goes back to what you said at the beginning, Tony, because you were saying how, you know, our microbiome seeded, you know, when we're in utero, we're getting lots of messages from our mother's bodies. And of course, they got messages from their mother's bodies. And I remember reading something once about health and well-being. It's like, well, if you can eat what you think your grandmother actually ate, then you'll probably be pretty near the mark of what's going to be healthy for you. And I know for sure my grandmother just didn't have access in those days, in the 20s and 30s, to anything processed. It was all like homemade lamb stew and vegetables and cheap as chips, but had to feed seven kids over the whole week. And, you know, lots of eggs and, you know, highly dense, nutritious food that was actual real food. So every now and again, I'm like, well, what did my granny eat? And then it makes me kind of come back into focus on what I want to put on my plate.
There's so I think refrigerators and freezers are brilliant, absolutely fantastic. However, if things are refrigerated and processed, things were dug up out of the vegetables and put in a can and whatever, processed, I don't know, it's just, what are we doing to ourselves? And you're absolutely right, we are what our grandmother ate, and we just need to embrace the good bits of the world we live today, but bring a little bit of granny with you.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. I'd love to do one of your 30-day microbiome resets. You should get us all involved on those. That sounds amazing.
That's a great idea. Then yes.
Yeah, I'm in. I have a cat, and I do love a dog, though. I don't have many friends with dogs, but I'm now going to actively go and search out and get some puppy cuddles, I think. And
cats are good. Cats are half as good as dogs, because the thing is with cats, they go outside, that's great, mm-hmm. and they come back in, but then they just sit on the sofa or curl up and they don't go and bomb around the plate. Well, maybe your cat does. Dog-like cats might do, but they don't come and lick you automatically and all the things that a dog does. So there's research that, so furry pets, so cats are good, but dogs are better.
I think you're going to start a big debate with that, and cat-dog debate since the beginning of time. And I'd just like to add that my beloved Rufus regularly sticks her face in my face. And so and I have definitely been licked and sat on and, yes, and really wondered the number of times I've gone to the kitchen surface and smacked a sandwich down on it and eaten it, and then thought about where she's just been and where she's been at. I'm now going to feel very justified in my lack of squirting the Dettol.
So what have you got coming up then, Tony? You mentioned the conference and the new film. Do you want to just give everyone the rundown of what you've got coming up so they can tune in and join you?
Anyone's welcome to join us. We're having an international conference at the April 20 when this goes out. But if you're listening to this before the end of April, so it's April 29th and 30th. It's a virtual conference, which we're for the global community. So we're hoping to have childbirth educators, midwives, doulas, parents, informed parents, and just to bring everybody together. And we've got a fantastic bunch of scientists who are speaking, scientists and other thought leaders. And the whole idea is to bring everybody to say, right, we need to raise awareness of this with the world. How are we going to do it? And so to hear voices and for us all to talk together. And then we've got a film coming out later this year, so our new kind of film. And everybody can have screenings, or everyone can have little watch parties. That'd be fantastic. We've got a free app coming up to support the film. We've got another conference at the end of the year where we could, that's a sort of strategy conference. So if people want to connect or learn more, go to microbirth.com or our teaching platform, which is microbirth.teachable.com. So, or just search my name. Search my name, Tony Harmon, and you'll find I'm on everywhere.
Super. What's the new film called, Tony?
I can't tell you.
Ooh, edge of the seat for that one. Looking forward to that. So we like to ask our guests three questions, Tony. The first one is, we believe each baby brings with it a gift or maybe a talent or something within us we didn't know we had. Do you agree? And what did your little one bring you? And I find this really odd to ask you, having heard your story, because it seems so obvious. But tell us in your words, do you agree?
Yes, I think becoming a parent completely changes the way people think. And it's completely changed me. And the greatest gift my daughter's brought me is the microbiome and the power to change and to how to change the world. And it's brought the awareness that we can all make a difference and we've all got a part to play. And if we can all join together, so that's parents with midwives, with childbirth educators, with doctors, we can change the health of the next generation.
Wow, what a gift. Can we thank your daughter for that one as well, please? Wonderful. We do our version of the guilty feminist, I'm a feminist, but we change it to I'm a yoga teacher, but. So perhaps something that people might not associate with an award-winning filmmaker and author. Have you got a guilty confession you'd like to share with us?
I'm a filmmaker and a course creator kind of microbiome person, but actually my just guilty pleasure is just Netflix. Is romantic comedies and thrillers and rubbish TV. But I'm thinking it's good for me because I relax and I kind of go into that kind of a really relaxed state. So yes, I'm all about nature and getting out into nature, but actually I just like being at home watching the TV.
I love that. And what are you grateful for in your life right now?
I'm grateful for being on your podcast.
Oh, we're grateful.
Thank you so much, Tony.
We're very grateful too. Thank you so much. This has been so fascinating. I've loved every minute talking to you. Thank you for joining us. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again when this new research is coming out. It sounds like this is an ongoing conversation. So we'd love to stay part of that with you.
I'd love you to stay part of this journey we're all on together. And I think everybody plays a part, and you're playing an important part by spreading awareness. And I think we all, if we want change to happen, I honestly, to my heart, believe that we need more support for the physiology of pregnancy, birth and early infancy, and how we are supposed to, as in we have evolved to give birth and to breastfeed, and then we need more support for parents to, more support, more education. And I think if we want change to happen, then we all have to play a part. We all have to stand up and be counted. So thank you for allowing me to be on your podcast.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure, Tony. Super delighted to have you.